This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I'll be reading articles of interest from magazines like Hobby Farms and Mother Earth News. Today's half hour will concentrate on some gardening articles. Let's get started with Hobby Farms magazine, January-February 2024. This first article is entitled Biochar Equals Better Soil. This Ancient Technique Improves Gardens for Small-Scale Farmers by Moira K. McGee. In the world of sustainable gardening, biochar has been gaining attention for its promising ability to improve soil for small-scale farmers. This technique dates back thousands of years and is making a comeback as a modern solution to potentially enhance soil fertility, increase crop yields, and reduce environmental impacts. Let's dig into the nitty-gritty of biochar and discover its potential for small and large gardeners everywhere, with the help of some soil scientists at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Isn't biochar just charcoal? Many people consider biochar to be the same thing as charcoal. However, they're the same, but different. While they're essentially the same product, the ingredients and purpose of the products differ. Ariel A. Zoghi, Ph.D., is a distinguished senior research scientist and research leader with the USDA Agricultural Research Service at the Coastal Plains Soil, Water, and Plant Research Center in Florence, South Carolina. He and his colleagues, Thomas Ducey and Kyung Ro, also scientists at ARS Florence, explained the difference is predominantly in the end application. When people think of charcoal, they mainly think of cooking and heating, Zoghi says. At the same time, biochar is manufactured to be used primarily as a soil amendment. The processes are otherwise similar, as both rely on pyrolysis, which involves high temperatures in the absence of oxygen. Still, given biochar's ultimate destination, i.e. the soil, biochar will often be produced to avoid, reduce, or eliminate potential contaminants that would be detrimental to the soil and or plants. Kurt Spokas is a research soil scientist with the USDA ARS based in St. Paul, Minnesota. His work focuses on the connections between soil health, water quality, biochar, and greenhouse gas emissions. Spokas's research with biochar examines its ability to provide environmental benefits for agrochemical sorption and N2O emission reductions while studying the impact of biochar's aging in the soil. Both biochar and charcoal refer to the same solid product of biomass pyrolysis, Spokas says. In general, the difference is that charcoal is the name given to the product when the use is for energy, and biochar is the name given to the solid product when the purpose is carbon sequestration. Additionally, charcoal is typically derived from wood, whereas biochar is formed from any organic material. Garden benefits. When used appropriately, biochar is a powerful soil additive that helps farmers reach maximum crop productivity. It also improves soil health and creates a haven for beneficial microorganisms to increase microbial activity while minimizing environmental impacts. Per the United States Biochar Initiative, biochar is a sustainable soil amendment that builds soil organic carbon, sequesters carbon, reduces soil acidity, improves nutrient retention, alleviates compaction, and increases crop yields and soil moisture. Biochar can provide several benefits to the soil, Zoghi says. First is adding carbon back into the soil that's lost primarily through microbial activity. Every time soil is disturbed, such as when the soil is tilled or seeds are planted, microbes are exposed to air and become active. Microbes use carbon as a food source, so biochar is a way to replenish soil's carbon pool. Some of the carbon in biochar is readily accessible and used immediately by microbes. In contrast, some of the carbon will take longer to break down, meaning the soil microbes will have a food source for years after the biochar application. Many of these microbes beneficially interact with plants, keeping plants healthy and thriving, Zoghi says. Biochar is a porous material that acts like a sponge. This property allows it to absorb water and nutrients and can help reduce nutrient runoff after fertilizer applications. How and where to use biochar? You can use common farm equipment to apply biochar to your garden, including broadcast seeders, compost manure spreaders, lime spreaders, seed drills, and tillage implements. The equipment you use largely depends on the biochar particle size and your cropping system, farm size, and other crop management practices. On a small scale, you can simply broadcast biochar directly to the soil surface by hand. While on a larger scale, consider using a compost manure or lime spreader. Ideally, you should combine biochar with other amendments during application to reduce the risk of wind erosion. When possible, mix biochar into the soil using tillage implements to further minimize losses. Because biochar can resist decomposition in soil, it can provide beneficial effects over multiple growing seasons with a single application. Because biochar doesn't typically require an annual application, such as synthetic fertilizers, compost, manures, and other amendments, it could also potentially save money over the long term. While you can add biochar to your garden in many ways, many commercial manufacturers recommend how to use their biochar products. Manufacturers also typically recommend how much to apply to the soil. A couple of the more common ways biochar can be added to soil are by mixing tilling directly into the top 4 to 6 inches of soil, or mixing in with compost before top dressing or being used as a potting medium, Zoghi says. However, there's no specific recipe for application amounts. Depending on the biochar selected for use, it can be possible to add too much. Suppose it's being added to compost before top dressing. In that case, many manufacturers recommend adding biochar at 10% to 20%, percent by volume, to the compost. A similar amount, 10% to 20% by volume, can be used for potting mixes and backfill. If broadcasting or mixing directly into the soil, the most common application rates tend to be 1% to 2%. Spokas stresses that biochar has been hyped as a panacea for all soil deficiencies. However, the name biochar does refer to a suite of different products because biochar from wood will provide significantly fewer nutrients to soil than biochar created from a manure waste stream. Or stated in a more concise fashion, not all biochars are the same. Therefore, the best guidance currently is to select the biochar based on a particular soil deficiency you're trying to address, he says. However, there's a lack of clear guidance on the exact biochar amounts that should be applied, and current recommendations are a result of empirical evidence rather than theoretical predictions. There's a lack of dose response studies in the literature that would be very useful in determining these thresholds across a variety of soil and crop types. There's also a limit to how much biochar can be applied to a particular soil, but the amount is soil, climate, and crop specific. Spokas says that biochar performs better when selected to overcome a targeted soil deficiency rather than as a general soil additive to an already productive soil. Making backyard biochar. Although numerous commercial suppliers exist nationwide, you may not have one in your area. If you must have it delivered to your location, delivery charges could add up on top of the cost of the product, making it less cost-effective. However, many major retailers carry various biochar products and often offer free delivery for orders meeting their parameters. It's also possible to make your own, but it's somewhat time-intensive and has other drawbacks. However, many small producers do successfully make their own backyard biochar and have learned various tricks to make it easier and more cost-effective than buying commercial products. There are numerous videos and information online for individuals to make biochar at home, Spokas says. However, since we can't accurately control temperature, heating rates, cooling times in these homemade or low-tech systems, the actual chemical and physical properties in each batch of biochar can be unique. Thereby, this does potentially hamper the use of the biochar product, since it may or may not perform similarly to the previous batches. I often use the analogy to meal prep. If we handed out the same ingredients and cooking directions for a particular recipe, what do you think the chances are that everyone following the recipe will produce a dish tasting the same? The do-it-yourself biochar community is extensive and creative. Many have documented their experiences on YouTube. The USBI is also a good source of information on biochar-related products and producers, and they often conduct and host workshops. One way to make your own biochar to heat the biomass, wood, grass, or even manure feedstocks without air. Our lab uses a stainless steel retort heated by a surrounding heater, Zogi says. An inert gas, such as nitrogen gas, continuously flows into the retort while heating to provide a non-oxygen environment and uniform heat transfer to the biomass. The problem when making your own biochar is that unless you provide a way to condense the exit gas and trap tar, the process becomes very messy, with tarry oil from the condensation of the exit gas. The tar contains various chemical compounds, including polyaromatic hydrocarbons, that may contaminate the air, water, and soil if not properly handled. Once you've made your biochar, you also must charge it, also referred to as activating it. One of the simplest ways to accomplish this is to mix it with your compost piles. This method benefits the biochar as well as the compost. Other popular ways to activate biochar include adding steam while heating the biochar at higher temperatures, using strong acids or bases, using CO2 or air. Like other aspects of making your own biochar, how you activate it may cause your biochar to have very different properties. Stored biochar lifespan. If you've gone to the time and effort of making your own biochar, a vital question you might ask is how long will the biochar last? Is it going to go bad before you can use it all? Although Spokas said this is still an active research area for biochar, there's evidence of its longevity for many years. Typically, biochar is assumed to be resistant to microbial mineralization, he says, and we do find evidence of its existence in soils for extremely long periods of time, more than 1,000 years. On the other hand, there have been numerous studies that have observed alteration in its behavior due to aging in the soil environment. Given the fact that the actual mechanisms of biochar's interaction in the environment haven't been fully elucidated, the duration of the positive soil health effects can't be accurately predicted. While biochar doesn't go bad or spoil, there's growing evidence that some of its characteristics can change as some types of biochar age. Several ARS laboratories are looking at this phenomenon and determining which biochar and their manufacturing conditions are more prone to these aging effects and whether these changes impact the biochar after application to the soil. Different types. When choosing materials to create biochar, a primary concern should always be how the different types of feedstocks will affect the soil and crop. Biochar's impact on soil is influenced by the original organic material, feedstock/biomass, and the pyrolysis conditions, time and temperature, used to make it. Feedstocks can be broadly classified based on the original organic material, including cellulosic, crop residues, rice hulls, grasses, for example, switchgrass, and straw, food waste, and other plant sources or byproducts, such as bagasse. Hardwoods, derived from tree materials discarded as yard waste, trees lost to disease, for example, pines killed by bark beetles, or trees raised primarily for biochar production. Manures, poultry litter, dairy and swine manure, and municipal treated sludge. Biochars from cellulosic and manure feedstocks are more likely to raise pH soil than hardwood feedstocks, Zogi says. In contrast, biochars from manure feedstocks are very good at binding heavy metals, which makes them an excellent choice when soil remediation is required. Biochar made from hardwood feedstocks is often good at influencing soil physical properties, allowing for greater soil aeration and increasing the soil's water-holding capacity. The temperature used to produce biochar also plays a significant role in how it impacts the soil. Higher temperatures generally result in a more stable carbon, taking longer to break down after being added to the soil. If carbon sequestration is a desired goal for the biochar user, hardwoods and higher temperatures are desirable, Zoji says. Different feedstocks can be blended or mixed to influence multiple soil physical, chemical, and biological properties. The same biochar affects various soils and also impacts crops differently. Unfortunately, the unpredictability of biochar applications has been an obstacle to its use for many years. The inconsistency in the yield response is what limited biochar's use back in the 1940s, being replaced by newly discovered synthetic fertilizers, Spokas says. Fertilizers offered a more predictable yield improvement and allowed the farmer to anticipate a particular crop productivity goal. The lack of consistent and predictable behavior of biochar in soils is still hampering a wider adoption today. While the USDA and USBI, as well as others, have identified many benefits associated with using biochar as a soil amendment, barriers to widespread use remain. Based on discussions and surveys of farmers by the USBI, some of the top reasons barring the adoption of biochar include a lack of trusted relevant information, minimal awareness and access to information, availability of technical assistance and decision support tools, biochar diversity and site specificity, the need for more research and cost versus economic benefits. Moira K. McGee spent many days on her grandma's farm. Now she picks her own crops and chases chickens on a hobby farm with her husband. See what else she writes about at www.moiramcgee.com. Let's switch now to Mother Earth News from the February-March 2024 issue. This is a firsthand report, Organic Gardening in the South. With a bit of strategy and a few tricks up your sleeve, you can beat the heat and keep your plants healthy. This is by Joanna Soloski. The first year I tried gardening in Sugar Land, Texas, in the Houston suburbs, I harvested a grand total of 4 tomatoes. The fifth and final year I gardened at that house, I had so many tomatoes I had to buy a canner. In the interim, I learned that southern gardens can be wonderfully productive, but it takes some planning. Heat and humidity dominate every aspect of gardening in the South. High levels of rainfall can lead to fungal problems and acidic soils. Summers are hot enough to prevent many popular garden plants from setting fruit. The high heat and humidity together are ideal for all kinds of insect pests. Fortunately, there are ways to cope with all of these issues that don't involve chemical sprays. When planning your garden, ask yourself, how high is the drainage table? To avoid pooling and fungal problems, many gardeners use raised beds. When I made my raised beds, I used cinder blocks. This wasn't the cheapest option, but heat and humidity break down untreated lumber within a few years. And treated lumber is usually treated with copper or arsenic, which I didn't want near my food. I lived about an hour away from the coast. The water table was high, so we installed drainage tiles adjacent to the vegetable garden. Between the raised beds and the drainage tiles, the vegetables never suffered from fungal problems. After considering your drainage table, find out what kind of soil you have. Soils in the South are typically acidic, but gardening lime, calcium carbonate, which increases soil's pH, is inexpensive and readily available. It's also considered acceptable in organic gardening, so I added a small amount. I added lava sand and Texas green sand the first year for the minerals, but after that, our homemade compost was enough. If you're unsure what kind of soil you have, state extension offices usually offer relatively inexpensive soil testing kits. If your soil is acidic enough that you want to add lime, soil tests can help determine the proper amount of that too. There are three main types of soil. Clay has the smallest particles, sand has the biggest, and loam has a good range of sizes. Loam is the most desirable for gardening, but if you don't have it right away, don't despair. Mixing organic material, such as finished compost, into the soil will improve its texture over time. One of the biggest perks of gardening in the wetter South is the speed with which you can make homemade compost. The heat and humidity break down everything so quickly. I had a pile in a corner of the yard where we dumped our lawn and vegetable kitchen waste. I sprayed it with the hose every time I watered the garden, turned it occasionally, and dug finished compost out of the bottom of the pile twice a year. My biggest mistake that first year, the reason I didn't really harvest anything, was in my timing. I grew up in the Chicago area and had no idea how heat affected plants. I simply thought, well, Houston has a long growing season, so I can plant whatever, whenever. Nope. Heat affects plants almost as much as frost does. Tomatoes, for example, may struggle to set fruit if nighttime temperatures are above 75 degrees Fahrenheit and daytime temperatures are above 95 degrees, which is much of the summer. I found I needed to start my tomato seedlings indoors toward the end of January and set them out around Valentine's Day to get them growing and setting fruit before the really hot weather showed up in May. I needed to plant cucumbers and bell peppers early, too. Bell peppers set fruit and develop well when temperatures are between 60 and 80 degrees. In the South, that's fall and spring weather. Cucumbers still grow in heat, but their flavor suffers once daytime temperatures are consistently above 90 degrees. My squash plants grew beautifully, but direct sun and the heat of summer wilted their leaves, along with the cucumber leaves. So we put in a shade cloth, which is just burlap stretched over some wooden frames to help de-stress the plants. Once temperatures cooled in fall, I could just take down the burlap. Some southern gardeners let their tomato plants live through summer and set another round of fruit in fall, and that's definitely an option. However, I yanked my tomato and cucumber plants after harvesting all the fruit in late summer. This gave me room for fall vegetables. My garden near Houston was Zone 9, which meant it did freeze every year, but the temperatures rarely dropped below 25 degrees. As northern gardeners know, many vegetables won't be harmed by a few days of temperatures that hover around freezing. So toward the end of summer, I'd remove my spent tomato and cucumber plants, add finished compost, and then put in my plants that enjoyed cooler temperatures. We could get Swiss chard, carrots, and turnips through winter months until all danger of frost was past, and then it was time to return to summer vegetables. Reading your seed packets is important when gardening anywhere, but it's especially important in the South because the intense heat restricts what you can grow. For the same reason, I also strongly encourage anyone in the South to find a locally owned and operated garden center. They're far more likely to carry well-adapted varieties than national chains are. Gardeners in the South are zones 8 through 10, and knowing your zone will tell you your area's average low temperature. You'll also need to know your average day for the last frost. In Sugar Land, my average last freeze date was around February 15. If you're unsure, you can check online or ask at a garden center. Also, watch the weather forecast and exercise common sense. If your average last freeze date is approaching, but so is an unseasonably cold snap, delay planting as needed. Circumstances other than freeze dates affect how well plants will do too. The right varieties can make a world of difference. For example, onions come in varieties specific to day length. Gardeners in Chicago need to use long day onions, while gardeners in Houston need short day varieties. Gardeners in Nashville may get lucky either way, but if a Houston gardener tries growing a Chicago onion, the bulb won't develop. Some varieties also perform better in resisting insect attacks. The squash vine borer can cause a lot of trouble in southern gardens, but Florida's land-race Seminole pumpkin suffers less than other varieties. Many popular vegetables are native to temperature climates, though cultivars bred to thrive in humid subtropical climates exist. You just need to look for them. And some lesser-known but still quite delicious edible plants are native to the South. In general, native plants require the least amount of maintenance because they co-evolve with the climate and other plants and organisms, including pests. If you don't plan on moving anytime soon, many native plants provide delicious fruit. Persimmons, pawpaws, and scuppernong grapes are all native to the southern United States and will require less maintenance than many non-native fruits. I feel strongly about gardening organically for a variety of reasons and didn't consider chemical sprays an option. Within 2 years, I found that providing good drainage and partial shade during the hottest time of the year, feeding my soil with compost, finding my ideal planting times, and using well-adapted varieties solved most of my pest problems. Foliar feeding every 2 weeks helped as well. Texas gardening stores carried a mix called Garrett Juice, which I haven't seen in other parts of the country. It was great. If you don't have it in your area, you can order it online. Crop rotation was also important for breaking the life cycle of various pests. I had 3 sections of garden I rotated through, so nothing grew on the same ground more than once every 3 years. Gardening in the South takes some investigative work and experimentation. Most of the popular gardening books and websites are aimed at gardeners in more temperate climates, though Howard Garrett's Texas Gardening the Natural Way is a great resource for southern gardeners who want to go organic. The southern states are lush and full of life. Many southern gardeners harness that natural energy to create beautiful gardens. With some research and planning, you can too. Joanna Soloski got really good at gardening along the Gulf Coast just in time to move to central Colorado, where she's been gardening and raising animals for her family and friends since 2014. We have just a little bit of time left, so we're going to switch publications and go with Self-Reliance Magazine from the spring 2024, issue number 32. And this regular column is called Ask Jackie. Jackie Clay Atkinson answers readers' questions on canning, livestock, and homesteading. Amish coleslaw. I have been trying to find your Amish coleslaw recipe and have not been successful. Seems like all I can do is find Amish coleslaw in various comments that people have made. This was asked by Jean in Swainsboro, Georgia. There are several Amish coleslaw recipes, says Jackie, but this is the one I've been using lately. Here are the ingredients. For the syrup, 3 cups of vinegar, 4 cups of sugar, and 1 teaspoon of celery seed and 1 teaspoon of mustard seed. 1 head of cabbage, 1 large carrot, and 1 small onion. Boil syrup ingredients together until sugar is dissolved. Turn off the heat. Shred the vegetables like in coleslaw. Pour syrup over vegetables and mix well. Pack into pint jars, leaving a half inch of head space. Process in a boiling water bath canner for 10 minutes. Remember to adjust your time if you live over 1,000 feet in elevation. Consult your canning book for directions. Here's another recipe. Beet relish. Do you have a recipe for beet relish? I want to do something more than just can the beets. Any ideas would be gratefully accepted. Holly Phillips, Blackfoot, Idaho. Sure, Holly. Here's a good one. 4 pounds of medium-sized beets, 2 small onions, 2 sweet red peppers, 4 cups of cabbage, finely shredded, 3 teaspoons of salt, 2 cups of sugar, and 3 cups of vinegar. Clean and remove the skins, root, and tops of the beets. Grind the beets, onions, and red peppers using the fine cutter of a food mill. Add the cabbage, salt, sugar, and vinegar. Heat to boiling and simmer for 10 minutes. Ladle into hot, sterilized jars and process in a boiling water bath for 15 minutes. Remember to increase your processing time if you live over 1,000 feet in elevation. Consult your canning book for directions. Canning green beans with bacon. My wife and I really enjoy the green beans that are served at one of the big steakhouse franchises. They mainly contain onion, bacon, sugar, and some pepper. When I can this next season's green bean harvest, would it be safe to add these ingredients to the beans? And if so, what would you recommend for the time needed in the pressure canner? That was asked by Bill Keller of Cassville, Pennsylvania. Although for many generations, folks have been adding these ingredients to their canned green beans as flavorings and just using the time normally used for pressure canning green beans, this is unsafe. When you add bacon, you can potentially upset things. What you can do is either mix up the beans as you wish, then process pints for 75 minutes or quarts at 90 minutes, which is necessary for recipes containing meat at 10 pounds pressure. Or don't add the bacon to the jars and instead add it when you plan on serving the beans. The onion powder, sugar, and pepper won't hurt a thing. And that was Jackie's response. Well, we're out of time. You've been listening to another episode of Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. As always, thanks for listening.